Welcome, everybody, and welcome to Return to Shambhala. I'm Vicki Goodwin. This is my show, and I'm pleased to tell you that tonight Wayne Perdine is on for the, I think, the third or fourth time. Wayne has been on the show. I know once we talked about sun gazing, we discussed sun gazing, and another time we talked about Shambhala, about what Shambhala is about. And this tonight, today, Wayne, you're going to be talking about the spiritual symbolism of the Wizard of Oz.
Yes, the Wisdom of Oz.
The Wisdom of Oz, that's right. Excuse me. That's even better. You're going to be presenting a class over the Internet, over the Heart Center website, right? Through the Heart Center?
Well,
is that right,
actually,
Wayne?
It's going to be a live presentation at a Heart Center conference in Miami.
Oh, it's in Miami. Okay.
March 23rd through 25th.
Okay.
And, I would like to teach a course. I could teach a whole weekend seminar on it.
I know.
It's a fascinating topic, and there's so much potential for fun, interactive techniques,
mm-hmm.
which I'll be doing a little bit of at the conference in Miami.
Oh, that's great. So tonight we're going to get a little bit of an overview of what you're going to be presenting in Miami. Is that true?
I won't be saying much about the techniques, but I'll be presenting what I'll be sharing with my talk and slideshow.
Well, I'm excited to hear about your presentation, and everybody loves the Wizard of Oz, and now we're getting an inside view, the Wisdom of Oz. So why don't you just go ahead and talk about your class, your presentation, and I'll follow up with some questions.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a writer of children's books, I've always been interested in the spiritual and psychological symbolism of myths, folk tales, and fairy tales with their archetypal characters and plots. I was mostly interested in the European tales of Lang, Andersen, and Grimm. But it wasn't until about 4 years ago that I began studying the American fairy tales of L. Frank Baum, particularly The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which was one of the first books I ever read. I think I was like 5 years old when I read that book. And when I reread it 4 years ago, I was surprised to find that it was an allegory of Ascended Master teachings, because I saw concepts such as the threefold flame represented by the Scarecrow, Tin Man, and Lion, the etheric retreats symbolized by the Emerald City, the higher self represented by the Good Witch of the North, and the Dweller on the Threshold represented by the Wicked Witch of the West. Now, Baum even had his illustrator, William Denslow, depict the witch sitting on the threshold of her castle. Now, these are all concepts of theosophy and other Ascended Master organizations. So not surprisingly, I found out later that Baum and his family had become members of the Theosophical Society 8 years before The Wizard of Oz was published. Now, back then, in order to become a member of the society, you had to study the books written by Helena Blavatsky, such as Isis Unveiled. Then you had to take a rigorous test. So Baum was quite well-versed in the teachings, the Ascended Master teachings. In addition, I believe that he was inspired by the Masters, because he would wake up in the middle of the night and jot down ideas for the story. And when he was asked how he got the idea for the story, he told the reporter that it came out of the blue and that God used him as an instrument for his message of love, joy, and peace. Now, 4 years ago, I first wrote about the spiritual symbolism of the Wizard of Oz in a short article in the Heart Center's Heartbeat newsletter. And about a year later, I wrote a more extensive article for Examiner.com. And a couple of months ago, I was asked to give a short presentation on it for a Sunday service for the Heart Center. And I agreed. And this has since evolved into a two-hour play shop that I'll be giving as part of the Heart Center's Spring Conference in Miami on March 23rd, 25th. And I call it a play shop because even though participants will be doing spiritual work, it will be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just briefly mention some of the things we'll be doing. So I wanted to do something other than just talk and show slides. I wanted to give participants an experiential understanding of the Wisdom of Oz by introducing spiritual techniques. For example, when I talk about the symbolism of the cyclone, I have them get up and spin around. This is the first Tibetan rite of rejuvenation, which has the effect of getting all the chakras spinning and raising consciousness. Then when I talk about the magic circle of protection the Good Witch of the North plants on Dorothy's forehead, I have them stand up and invoke the circle or tube of light from their solar presence. Other activities we'll be doing include dancing to a violet flame waltz, inner child work, laughter yoga, singing the Ho'oponopono, and chanting the Om. At the end of my presentation, people will be in a heightened state of awareness and prepared to receive a heart stream from Melchizedek. I consider Melchizedek one of the highest masters of the Great White Brotherhood, right up there with Sanat Kumara, Maitreya, and Gautama Buddha. He's not really an ascended master because he was never born into a physical body.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Now, last May, I attended a Heart Center event in Los Angeles at which Melchizedek gave a heart stream. And just before he was announced, I experienced very tangibly wave upon wave of radiation. It was as though I was sitting in an ocean of light and waves of light were washing over me. It's a very tangible experience of the Master's presence. So I'm very much looking forward to his heart streaming in Miami. And I encourage your listeners to attend this conference. There will be other presenters there, such as Jed Shackleman, who's a musician and healer, who uses Tibetan singing bowls and tuning forks for sound healing. Donna Ferry will be there. She's an old friend of mine from Montana. She's a clairvoyant and an energy healer who will heartstream Mother Mary's radiation. She will also be available for private consultation. Felipe Alfonso is an angelologist who will teach people how to get in touch with their personal angel. And, of course, David Lewis will be there giving discourses, darshans, and dictations from the Masters and three chakra blessings for the heart, third eye, and the crown. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be quite an event.
It is.
And I hope your listeners can come, but for those who can't make it, I can at least talk a little more about my presentation that I'll be giving.
That sounds good.
So I plan on beginning by talking about the importance of fairy tales and why there's such a renewed interest in them nowadays. I was at a movie theater last month and there were advertisements for 4 upcoming movies based on fairy tales.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And I think the reason why there's such an upsurge in interest in fairy tales is that the archetypal characters, settings, and plots speak to our souls in a language of symbols and tell us the fundamental truths of existence. And they also inspire us with hope that good will overcome evil. So this knowledge and inspiration is food for the soul. And people's souls are hungry nowadays.
They are.
And all the great masters such as Omram Mikhail Ivanhoff and Rudolf Steiner encouraged their disciples to read fairy tales for their spiritual upliftment. And L. Frank Baum had quite a collection of all the classic fairy tales of Lang, Andersen, and Grimm. But he wanted to write his own American fairy tales, and he wanted them to be delightful, and like those of Lang, and not violent or tragic like the ones of Andersen and Grimm. So in 1898, he wrote Mother Goose in prose, followed by Father Goose, his book. And these were fairly successful, but he knew that he could do better. So in 1899, he set about writing his masterpiece, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, that incorporated all the wisdom he had gleaned from nearly 14 years of studying the periodicals and books of the Theosophical Society. So he began the story by painting a gray landscape of Kansas, both physically and emotionally. This contrasted sharply with the vibrant color and joyfulness of Oz, and later inspired the dramatic transition from black and white to technicolor in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he wanted to give the reader an emotional understanding of how much more vibrant and alive the etheric plane is compared to the drab colors and emotions of the physical existence. So that's the first symbolism we come across, that Kansas is earth, the earth or physical plane, and Oz is the etheric plane. And Dorothy symbolizes the soul, the feminine soul, and Toto, her pet dog, is her animating spirit. And the house that's carried away and crashes in Oz symbolizes Dorothy's body. So when she leaves it, she enters the astral plane in various levels of the etheric. And people do this every night when they go to sleep. Most people don't remember it, but they leave their body and go into the astral or the etheric. So the story could be seen as a dream or out-of-body experience, but I think it's more of a near-death experience. There's a deadly desert of shifting sands that surrounds Oz. On the other side are various countries containing monsters of the astral plane. This desert is symbolic of the ring pass knot that separates the etheric from the physical and astral planes. And when Baum lay on his deathbed, his last words were, "Now we can cross the shifting sands."
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that he can go to the etheric,
mm-hmm,
to prepare for re-embodiment. So Dorothy's journey is a near-death experience in which she learns some valuable lessons to help her pass her life tests when she returns to consciousness. So while she's in Oz, she encounters various characters, each of whom represents a different part of herself. The Munchkins are various aspects of her inner child. They're overjoyed because she inadvertently killed the Wicked Witch of the East, who represents her inner controlling parent. The Good Witch of the North represents her higher self, who guides and protects her. The Wicked Witch of the West represents her dweller on the threshold. And the Winkies, wolves, crows, bees, and flying monkeys are her bad habits that are allied with the dweller. She first encounters the Scarecrow, who symbolizes her undeveloped intellect. The Tin Man is her undeveloped love, and the Cowardly Lion is her undeveloped will. Just as she must integrate her outer and inner world, Kansas and Oz, she must purify, integrate, and balance her mind, heart, and will. And this is a major theme of The Wizard of Oz, and it's also a theme seen in another modern fairy tale, Princess Bride. There's also a wizard in Princess Bride. I've written an article on that.
Oh, okay.
Also, the wizard represents the guru, spiritual coach or minister that people tend to put too much stock in and hand their power over to. Dorothy's three companions want the wizard to give them qualities they think they lack, and Dorothy wants him to send her back home. But he sends them all on a quest or mission to kill the Wicked Witch of the West. In the process, they develop their latent qualities. Now, the way Dorothy kills the witch is very interesting in terms of how to deal with the dweller. If Dorothy had tried to fight the witch, she would have been defeated. Instead, she throws a bucket of water on the witch, and the witch dissolves. But it's not just any water, it's soapy water. So the lesson here is that the dweller is the amalgamation of all our impurities, all our impure thoughts, memories, desires, habits, and physical selves. And the way to defeat the dweller is by engaging in purification practices such as prayer, meditation, bhakti yoga, sun yoga, ho'oponopono, and fasting. So after Dorothy and her three companions return to the Emerald City, the wizard gives the Scarecrow, Tin Man, and Lion tokens or talismans of their attainment. He promises to take Dorothy back to Kansas in his balloon, but she misses the ride and despairs of ever getting back home until Glinda, the Good Witch, tells her that all along she had the power to go anywhere. All she had to do is close her eyes, click her silver slippers three times, and say where she wants to go. The silver slippers represent the silver cord that is attached to our base chakra and is the soul's connection to the body when we have out-of-body experiences. In the movie, they change them to ruby slippers because they look better technicolor. But in the book, they're silver. The book is much better than the movie because it has a lot more symbolism, a lot more interesting scenes. And there's also 13 sequels to The Wonderful Wizard of Oz that contain many more allegories and even direct references to Ascended Master teachings. For example, in the last book, Glinda of Oz, Baum introduces the adepts who have gained supernatural powers through their study of nature. These are like the master alchemist Saint Germain and other founders of the Theosophical Society. Baum wrote this book, Glinda of Oz, on his deathbed, and it's remarkable that in spite of his illness and suffering, he was able to maintain a positive attitude and express a sense of magical wonder and victory and joy in his last book. So, in conclusion, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz is by far the most read fairy tale of all time, having been translated into 50 languages in just about every country. And the movie was just as popular. More people have watched The Wizard of Oz than any other movie. And I think the reason why they're so popular is because people see the truth that Baum cleverly hid in the words and the scenes and characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this book has had an incredible enlightening effect on society in the last 111 years. That it's been in existence. I think it has raised the consciousness of mankind and made people more loving and more spiritual just by reading it.
And I'm thinking
what I hope to accomplish in my play shop in Miami, to help people see the wisdom of Oz and to incorporate it in their life. So, if you have any questions, I could talk for hours about this. So.
Well, you're welcome.
Do we have till 7?
the famous piece of music, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, so many people have sung that song.
Uh-huh.
It's such a beautiful song. The Rainbow? Could you talk about the rainbow a little bit?
Sure.
Okay.
First, I'll say that Somewhere Over the Rainbow was voted the greatest movie song of all time.
Oh, see, I didn't know it was the most watched movie. The song is, that's just amazing. Okay.
Yeah, it really is. And the rainbow symbolizes the seven rays that we each should master before we make our ascension. Is the white ray of purity, the violet ray of spirituality, the green ray of truth, abundance, and healing, the blue ray of protection and direction, the pink ray of love, yellow ray of wisdom, the purple and gold ray of service, and I think that's all.
I think
that's
it.
Color out?
And in the story, the yellow brick road is, you say it's, you feel that it's the yellow ray of wisdom. As they go off to Oz on the yellow brick road, they're in search of
the spiritual path of wisdom. And Baum also studied Buddhism in addition to theosophy, and in Buddhism they call the middle way the golden way or the golden path.
Right.
And if you go in Buddhist temples, the stones are a yellow color. They're made of yellow bricks.
Well, that's amazing. He was actually a member of the Theosophical Society when Madame Blavatsky was the organization?
He joined like 3 or 4 years after she died.
Okay. But he was a member.
'93.
Uh-huh.
And he learned it mainly from his mother-in-law. She was a very devout theosophist, and she would send the periodicals and books to her daughter and insist that she and her husband and children all study the literature of the Theosophical Society. And in 1892 or 93, they joined after reading Isis Unveiled and other books and passing a test. So it's not like today where you can just send in your dues and become a member. You really have to study hard and be tested.
The Holy Grail, so many movies and books have this Holy Grail symbolism, and so many people feel like it's a thing you go find. It's a grail. It's something outside of themselves. They're looking for a sword or a chalice. But the Holy Grail is also embedded in The Wizard of Oz. Is that right?
Yes. It's the purification of the soul so that it can receive the Holy Spirit. And you can see the soul is made up of the four elements. The lion is the fire. The tin man is the water of emotions. The scarecrow is the air element. And Dorothy is the earth element. And they get purified through their experiences, and once they are purified, these four elements can combine into the Grail so that it can receive the Holy Spirit. So the Grail isn't something that you find.
Right.
Like in the Grail legend, I think it was the knight Parsifal was pure enough to receive the Grail from the angels. So out of all the knights, he was the only one that could receive the Holy Grail because he was the purest knight.
Well, when we stand upright, stand on our own 2 feet, and we raise our arms into the air, we do, for our body forms a chalice, what looks like a chalice if you round the arms towards the sky. And so we are ourselves a Holy Grail. And I just wanted to point that out, that it's not something, it's not going to Oz, but it's within ourselves and ourselves.
Right. And also in solar science, there's a teaching on the Grail that is in our brain. Just below the pineal gland, there's a hollow space called the third ventricle, which is above the roof of the mouth. And when, through meditation and sun gazing, the pineal gland is activated and releases the what's called the Amrita, or the divine nectar, this is secreted into the third ventricle, or the Grail, and it has an immediate effect on the entire nervous system, that raises our consciousness to a state of bliss. And I've communicated with sun gazers who've had experiences of Amrita, and they told me that they can actually taste it, because when it fills the third ventricle, it leaks down the throat, and you can actually taste it. And they describe it as indescribable.
Indescribable.
There's
right.
Nothing comes close to a description of it. You know, it's like the sweeter than the sweetest substance you can eat. And its effect on their emotions and their consciousness is very uplifting. And it also causes you to see auras and be aware of people's feelings before you even interact with them. So that's another interpretation of the Grail. It's mm-hmm. actually something in our nervous system that's activated by meditation, prayer, and sun gazing.
You were talking about the Holy Grail and the purification process that the members went through. And one of the techniques that you talk about, that we talk about at the Heart Center, is the Ho'oponopono forgiveness. I think I talked about this with my guest last time we were on. I just think that if people don't know about it, it's something to talk about, if you don't mind. Can you talk about that, Wayne? I know there's a video.
I consider the Ho'oponopono the most powerful purification technique that just dissolves your past records of pain and hurt and anger. All the negative qualities of the dweller, they're just dissolved, just like the Wicked Witch of the West. And one of the techniques in my play shop will be singing the Ho'oponopono song.
And the dance that goes?
Yeah, the dance is a Violet Flame song that I composed. It's called the Dance of Love. And people will be waltzing to that.
Well, that'll be nice. So the prayer is, I love you.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you.
Correct.
And you don't have to really say it to the person. You just put it out there.
Uh-huh.
And
you're
releasing them. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Wayne.
Yeah, the philosophy behind the Ho'oponopono is that whatever is happening in your world, any negative thing like an accident or illness, either to yourself, your family members, or coworkers, or just strangers, like you witness a car accident on driving to work.
Mm-hmm.
According to the Ho'oponopono, you are responsible for everything in your world. And to some people, that sounds ridiculous. Say, what did I have to do with that car accident? But when you start saying the Ho'oponopono, you begin to see negative qualities in yourself that were involved in the accident, or the accident brings up memories of maybe accidents you were involved in the past. And it's like we all share a collective unconscious where all these negative tendencies reside. And if we take responsibility for our part in this collective unconscious and work on it with the Ho'oponopono by saying to ourselves, I love you, I'm sorry, please forgive me, thank you, over and over again, that we clean our unconscious, and by so doing, we have effect on the people around us. So, say you have a relative who is in a mental hospital. You do the Ho'oponopono, and you work on those insane impulses within your unconscious, and this, because your relative has a heart tie with you, what you clean in yourself has an effect on your relative. And the major proponent of the Ho'oponopono is Dr. Hugh Len. And there's an amazing story about several years ago, he was a psychiatrist at a mental institution in Hawaii. And he was in charge of a ward where they had criminally insane people. And what he worked 4 hours a day, and all he did when he was there was, let's say, the Ho'oponopono, while he looked at the files of all these criminally insane people.
You're kidding me. Oh, that's amazing.
He would do this day after day for months.
Uh-huh.
And after a while, the patients started getting better, but they didn't have to put them in chains. They were well behaved enough so that they could go outside and get exercise, and eventually they were declared well enough to go back into society. And after like 3 years, they had to close the ward down because there weren't any patients left.
That is amazing. Imagine if people, correctional officers, would go into the jails, the prisons, and do a few of those every day. The hospitals.
Uh-huh.
If there were just a few people just doing that, things would really accelerate.
Yeah.
The consciousness expansion that we're going through right now, it would accelerate. Not that it needs to be accelerated, because I heard it's really accelerating quickly, but that would be great. I didn't know that. I'm definitely going to do that at school, because that's easy. And by saying thank you, you're saying it's done. It's over. It's
yeah, you put closure to
it.
So, do you have any other questions about Frank Elfenbaum?
I do. Is there something that you'd like to say right now without me asking a question? I didn't know this was a book. That's how out of it I am. I didn't know that Fromm wrote the book, and then they made the movie. That's, should have known that, but I didn't. And there's so much more. Was there a golden cap in the movie,
oh, yeah,
or was that in the book? The golden cap
from
the Wicked Witch of the West?
Another symbol for the crown chakra.
Okay.
It was originally owned by one of the past rulers of Oz. And when the Wicked Witch of the West invaded Oz. She stole it from him. And it had the power to command the flying monkeys. And to do... It was like a magic lamp, like Aladdin and the magic lamp, that you could use it for three wishes and command the flying monkeys to fulfill those three wishes. And when Dorothy and her three companions were approaching her castle, she sent the Winkies, wolves, crows, and bees to attack them. But they were able to defeat all four of them. And her last recourse was the flying monkeys. And she had already used them two times, so this was her last time. And after that, the golden cap was useless. So if you watch the movie, there's a scene when she's ordering the flying monkeys to go get Dorothy and her companions, to destroy Dorothy and her companions, that she throws the golden cap because she's angry that Dorothy forced her to use the last wish. And then after Dorothy kills the Wicked Witch in the book, she finds the golden cap, and because she's the new owner of the golden cap, she has three wishes, and she uses one wish to transport her and her three companions back to the Emerald City. And I don't think she uses it again. I think she may have used it one more time when they were going to the home of the Good Witch of the South, and when she finally reaches the Good Witch of the South, she gives the golden cap to her, and the Good Witch, instead of using the gold cap, because she's not a black magician, she wouldn't use a talisman like the gold cap for selfish purposes, so she just releases the flying monkeys from their obligations, so they no longer have to serve any master of the gold cap.
Well, I bought the movie in high definition. It was one of the first movies to come out in high definition, and I still haven't watched it, but I'm going to pay closer attention now.
Yeah, they came out with a two-disc.
Yes.
The 70th anniversary, mm-hmm. Is that the one you have?
Uh-huh, that's the one I have, yeah.
Yeah, it has some good special features. They have a movie about the life of L. Frank Baum, which is pretty interesting.
Well, I'm glad I didn't know these things, because I'm truly asking you these questions that I don't know the answer to, that's for sure. I love the ending of the movie, where there's no place like home, but she never left home. She was always able to get back home.
Uh-huh.
And I love that. Even though I didn't know what they were talking about when I was young, we haven't left home. We're still in. God is still within us, and we're where we need to be. I just want to get closer to my God presence and be more connected in that way. But we've never left. We've never left. We're right there. Where we, if we just remember who we are, and that's that was
The book, instead of saying there's no place like home, she says, "Take me home to Aunt T.M."
Oh,
I think Auntie M is the mother.
Mother, yeah. The feminine, uh-huh.
The Divine Mother.
Well, we think we're going through the greatest shift in consciousness right now, this 2012, but wow, what a piece of work this was over 100 years ago, the books that were written. I don't know what happened that period. There was so much enlightenment going on. I don't know why we got into World War One and World War Two after all this beautiful. What happened?
Right around the time that the bombs became members of the Theosophical Society, there was the Chicago World Fair, and there was the international convocation of religions, and the keynote speaker was Vivekananda. And
who? Yogananda?
Vivekananda,
who?
Gave his talk. Frank Baum and his wife were in the audience. And I think he had a profound effect on Baum. There was a lot of other spiritual masters in that period. And Yogananda came.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the 20s, shortly after the bomb died in 1919.
Well, they were really waking up then to their God presence and their combining East and West philosophies, the symbolism of the chakras and the rays, the seven rays.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if could you talk about the dweller on the threshold? Exactly what is that dweller for the
uh-huh.
for the listeners? And how it relates to the Wizard of Oz?
Yeah, it's a concept that was first introduced by the Theosophical Society, although it's probably a concept that's thousands of years old in Hinduism and Buddhism.
Right.
Probably
yeah.
been called other terms. And what it is mainly the collection of all your negativities, not only in your present life, but from all your past lives. It just collects in what's been called the electronic belt that you take with you. It's like your baggage. And some people have more baggage than other people. And the effect it has is that it gets in your way of passing your tests. Like someone may have a test like maybe obedience and to a master.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a streak of rebellion in their dweller, past embodiments when they were a rebel. And just at the point where they're almost passing their tests, if they do this one thing that the master asks of them, and they will have gone on to a level of adeptship, and the master will feel that they're trustworthy enough to be granted a mantra that can give them spiritual power. But because of this streak of rebelliousness, they disobey the master. They don't do what the master asked. So they fail their initiation, and the master doesn't grant them the dispensation. And this happens time and again, lifetime after lifetime, until finally, through purification, the soul dissolves the dweller, or that part of it, that rebelliousness, and is able to obey the master and receive the power.
So in the Wizard of Oz, the witch is an example of the dweller. The dweller on the threshold. Is that right?
Right.
The wicked witch in the West
represents the dweller. Dorothy's fear of the witch is
fear.
That part of herself that is standing away of her passing that initiation. And the wizarders is like the guru who tells her to go on this mission to kill the wicked witch. And she doesn't want to kill the witch, but she sees that it's the only way to go home. And so, because her obedience overcomes her fear. Also, she does it because of her love for her three companions, because she wants them to be given the qualities that they lack, or they think they lack. So it's her love and her obedience helps her overcome her dweller, or her fear.
Okay. Interesting symbolism. Well, Wayne, it's getting close to almost time to come to an end. Would you like to say anything more? Add anything you're dying to say, or talk about Miami? Boy, Miami, March 23 through the 25th. What a great time to be in Miami. That
yeah,
is
I can,
perfect.
Talk a little bit about the conference.
Sure. And the website, too, where they can...
Uh-huh. Yeah, they can go to Heart Center, www.heartcenter.org, and the event page should be up tomorrow, so if people go to that website tomorrow, just click on the event tab, and there should be a page for the Miami event. And the title of the event is Beyond Awakening. So I can tell people about the presenters.
Sure.
I'll begin with talking about David. He's a mystic, spiritual teacher. He's a song composer, an author, and he's studied the major world religions for decades. And about 8 years ago, he had a mystical awakening and began receiving telepathic messages from the Ascended Masters. And he says that he's not the only messenger. He says that each of us have, with our gifts, can become messengers. And there's even another person at the conference who I consider to be a messenger. That's Donna Ferry. And I've known Donna for almost 30 years. We were on staff together at a ranch in Montana. And she's an amazing person. She's very close to Mother Mary and other masters. And I've consulted with her several times. She's revealed some of my past embodiments and the lessons that I need to learn in this embodiment. And she's very sweet, very full of what I would call the mother light. And she's going to be heart-streaming Mother Mary's radiation. And I think that'll be a very profound meditation, a very healing meditation.
Yes.
And I'm looking forward to hearing Felipe Alfonso's presentation on angels. He says that people can get in touch with angels and have them as aids in their spiritual path, or guides in the spiritual path. And also the angels can help them with their healing, their emotional and physical healing.
You know what they help me do? I can't find my ball on the golf course, and they point it out to me. And then where I look, there it is. You know, it might be just a little bit off the green, but the grass is a little bit tall, and then all of a sudden it comes into my view. They help me all the time. I know that's silly, but that way I know they're there, you know, and I don't think they mind. I think they kind of enjoy me playing golf.
You know, I think angels love it when we call on them for help, no matter how trivial.
Oh, I got an email from Seth. He said we had to wrap it up. Thank
okay.
you, Wayne, so much
for
coming on. I like to go to the conference, and I encourage everybody to go to the website and look at the information, and I hope to see you there. Thank you again, Wayne. Wonderful presentation.
Yeah, thank you, Vicki.
Okay, all right.
Take care.
Good night. Okay. Goodbye.